Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Anthony Bibolo and I'm the Deputy Director of the Lowy Institute. And it's a great pleasure to be hosting once again Haider Alkhoei. Haider's spoken here at the Institute before and it's great to have him back. So please join me in thanking Haider. Haider is the director of the Centre for Shia Studies in London and a doctoral researcher at the University of Exeter, focusing on US foreign policy and ethno-sectarian politics in Iraq. Prior to this, he was a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, an associate fellow of the Middle East and North Africa program at the Royal Institute of International Affairs. Like I said, Haider, it's great to have you back, and it's great Haider's taken time out of his leave. He's actually in Australia on holiday this time. We didn't bring him. We brought Haider to Australia about two years ago now. How time has flied. 2 years ago, but he's back in Australia on holiday, so he's taken some time out from seeing the sights to join us, and we're very, very, very grateful for that. We brought Haider in because we wanted to talk about a really important topic, and that is the current situation in Iraq. All of us would have seen the events of the last year in which the kind of coalition forces have basically destroyed Islamic State's caliphate that extended from Syria down into Iraq. So it's an incredibly fluid and dynamic situation, and we're really grateful to have someone of Haider's expertise to talk about it. So let's just start there with the current situation on the ground. You were in Iraq last time in December. What is at the Iraqi end of the caliphate? What's the situation? What remains of Islamic State? And what remains for the Iraqi government and for coalition forces to do in finally eradicating that threat?
Thank you. It's, of course, a pleasure to be back at the Lowy Institute in Sydney and to be here with you again today. Big picture-wise, I think one of the big changes we've seen in Iraq that's not really appreciated outside of the country is just how far the country has come in these 3 years. I was in Baghdad in June 2014 also when Mosul fell. Just the morale that was broken, there was no army. 40,000 police and soldiers routed by a few hundred militants. The situation was extremely dire. The so-called caliphate literally knocking on the gates of Baghdad, 20, 30 kilometers away from the capital, with the Americans expecting the capital could fall also within 72 hours. And if you remember back, even 2014, 2015, a lot of pundits, experts were talking about the end of Iraq. You know, this is a challenge too great for a country this week to handle. And yet here we are. The caliphate is destroyed. There is no Islamic State in Iraq. There are ISIS remnants. They have very little freedom of movement in some of the rural areas in the west and north, but they do not control any territory in the country. And of course, this was a number of factors. It wasn't just the coalition input, which was important. You know, over 30,000 airstrikes. Iraq had immediate military assistance from the Iranians. The people themselves rose up after the army was broken at a crucial moment in the country's history in 2014 with the popular mobilization forces. But I think more important than that, in 2015 and 2016, and this changed the game when it came to the fight against ISIS. More and more Sunni Iraqis understood that despite all the propaganda and rhetoric of ISIS protecting Sunnis and defending the Sunni communities, they are the ones whose communities were decimated. They are the ones who paid the ultimate price. Of course, minorities, you know, we saw genocide against Yazidis, genocide against the Christians, but the Sunni community in Iraq wasn't, you know, for hundreds of years, they were the kingmakers in the country and they lost everything. So the Sunni engagement and mobilization alongside the Iraqi security forces, I think, really sped up the defeat of ISIS. And again, this is crucial to bear in mind because, you know, I also went to the IDP camps in Abu Ghraib, west of Baghdad, talking to civilians who had fled their homes. And yes, there was anger at the central government, and we can talk later about the problems, the fuel that the central government making matters worse for Sunnis, but a lot of their anger was directed at Sunni politicians themselves and the Sunni elite who in the early days, 2011, 12, 13, they escalated the sectarian rhetoric. But when ISIS showed up, these guys were living in five-star hotels and villas in Erbil, in Kurdistan, in other Arab cities. It wasn't them who paid the price. So I think it's a massive shift in the country.
I wanted to pick you up on that because in some senses we've seen this before, right? So in the mid-2000s, there was a Sunni insurgency, a jihadist insurgency in Iraq. Some of the kind of characters who ended up in Islamic State were participated in that insurgency. The real turning point in the fight against that insurgency was the decision by Sunni leaders essentially to realize that this was doing more damage to them and to turn against the Sunni insurgents. But then we had a situation where the Sunni community felt that sacrifice, that decision, wasn't rewarded by the central government in Baghdad, and it was the kind of the harsh treatment that was meted out by particularly the government of Nour al-Maliki towards the Sunni communities that created the conditions for the emergence of Islamic State. What's to stop that happening again? I mean, what does the government in Baghdad need to do to kind of really leverage this, again, the kind of the shift in the Sunni community's attitude towards Islamic State, sure, and the turning point?
You're right. And there was also back then confidence that we've defeated Al-Qaeda. Yeah. But two things happened which enabled ISIS to rise. One was complete US disengagement. The Obama administration did not at all want to touch Iraq. They saw this as, the Bush administration's war. They want nothing to do with it. Their complete withdrawal from the country really did leave the security vacuum. But I think more important than that was the way in which the central government dealt with the Sunni community. And this has changed with the current prime minister. So the former prime minister, with the Americans out of the country, he overcompensated. He wanted to show that he was in charge and he had the power and that the US withdrawal wouldn't affect security. And he enacted a series of extremely heavy-handed measures, security measures, which I think pushed a lot of Sunnis, if not towards ISIS, just not towards the government, preferring to have insurgents run their cities than the central government. But with the election of Prime Minister Abadi in 2014, this is a bit strange because technically Maliki is still his boss. Maliki is still the head of the party. But the Prime Minister is very different in his attitude, in his policies. For a starter, he comes from an urban center from the capital, Baghdad. Maliki came from a rural area in the south of the country. Abadi has a PhD from a British university. He's much better educated. He's an engineer. He's process orientated, results orientated, and he's much more diplomatic, which can work against him if people see that as being indecisive and weak. But this is the irony. We had a supposed strongman running the country who lost literally one third of Iraq. And now we have a supposedly weak, indecisive prime minister, and yet he's reclaimed the country. And not just reclaimed the country, but managed to balance Iraq's relations with its neighbors in a way which Maliki couldn't do. So those two things will prevent an ISIS 2.0 from emerging. But again, coming back to the Sunni community, and I think that's more important than what the central government can do. So I was in Mosul as the Iraqi forces were encircling the city, just about to storm it. And I was listening to a pirate radio station in ISIS-held Mosul of Maslawis, people in Mosul, A, wishing the Iraqi securities a swift victory, which, 3 years ago, they were pelting them with rocks, telling them to leave their city. But the message they were constantly sending was, let's be more vigilant this time. Let's not allow others to divide us. And this is what ISIS played extremely well. Acting as a sort of vanguard or protector of the Sunnis. But I think 3 years on, if there was any doubt as to who or what ISIS was, it's now very clear. And I think the Sunni community themselves will be extremely more vigilant.
I mean, one of the things you raised it there. One of the things that has become critical now is how Iraq manages its relations with its various neighbors. With the fight against Islamic State, at least from the coalition's perspective, seemingly over, what seems to be, there seems to be a shift in focus, particularly on the part of the US, to Iran's role in Iraq. And there are the risks, obviously, I mean, it's not that the US and Iran were exactly allied, but in a sense, they were kind of tolerating each other's activities whilst the focus was on Islamic State. How is that likely to change now that Islamic State is defeated? And how is the Iraqi government going to manage what could be an accelerated conflict between its two most important allies?
I think it hasn't changed as much as people expected it to change under Trump. So if you look at Syria next door, the American Air Force is literally bombing pro-Iran units on the ground who are supporting the Syrian government. But in Iraq, I don't know what you want to call it, deconfliction, tacit alliance. To some extent, it's still there. The Iranians and the Americans, despite all the rhetoric, despite the public show of animosity towards each other, they both share common interests in Iraq, which is supporting stability in the central government. And of course, they both share common threats in Iraq, which is terrorism. And for the Iraqi government, it's in a very awkward position, but, and this is probably to the Prime Minister's credit, we can criticize him for his dealing with corruption and other policies, but when it comes to handling Iran-US relations, he's done this remarkably well. And I think it reflects not just the Prime Minister's position, but a more wider sense from the Iraqis themselves that we cannot defeat ISIS. We couldn't have defeated ISIS without both support from Tehran and support from DC. And in some battles, which were controversial, and if you look at some of the US media, you literally had pro-Iran units, failing to breach defenses and US airstrikes clearing the way for them. And of course, it's controversial in Washington and in some anti-Iran circles. But for the Iraqis, it was a recognition that we cannot do this alone, and they have managed it extremely well.
But how do you manage it going forward? I mean, recently the U.S. ambassador in Iraq saying, questioning Iran's presence, Iran's role in Iraq. I mean, is it going to be? I mean, obviously, does it become more difficult to manage? And is there a way to manage those two relationships?
So yes, of course, it will be more difficult to manage because ISIS was the thing that brought both Iran and the U.S. On the same page. In Iraq, it's going to be extremely difficult for the Iraqi government. But what makes it easier, it hasn't been easy so far, but what makes it easier is, I think, recognition from the American side that whilst we have problems with Iran in Syria, whilst we have problems with Iran's nuclear program, in Iraq, and I think the Americans are more pragmatic than they like to pretend, it's not an ideological campaign. There's a recognition that in Iraq, Iran could really hurt the Americans. And that's what Iran does well. It's the soft politics. It's the supporting small armed units on the ground. Of course, tank versus tank, missile versus missile, Iran stands no chance. But on the ground, as we've seen in both Syria and Iraq, Iran is a much smarter player. The US could escalate. They could send special forces teams to take out particular commanders that they don't like. But I think they also understand the ramifications of that will be disastrous, not just for US presence in Iraq, but for the region. So again, despite the rhetoric we see in public, I think there's more pragmatism at on the ground level.
Right. I also don't want to kind of keep the discussion about Islamic State. I mean, I think it's obviously an interesting time in Iraq more generally. You've got the parliamentary elections coming up. I mean, one report that caught my eye was the way in which even formerly religious parties are now kind of setting religion to one side, at least in their campaigning for the elections. I mean, how true is that? And is that one of the consequences of the defeat of Islamic State?
So this is one of the most interesting political shift we're seeing in the discourse itself. They're moving away, the politicians, that is, they're moving away from, previous very overt sectarian rhetoric to a much more nationalist discourse. Now, I don't believe politicians either way, right? When they were talking about religion and sectarianism, me and a lot of Iraqis didn't believe they were religious or sectarian. They just understood the potency of sectarian rhetoric as a means to mobilize the Iraqi people. The fact that now they're shifting back to nationalism. Again, I don't think it represents their own personal conviction that they were wrong and now we need to move to, towards nationalism. It's a recognition that the Iraqi people themselves are fed up of sectarian politics and sectarianism. So in that sense, I think it's extremely encouraging. Whether or not you believe the politicians, the fact they're saying this in public is an indication of what the people themselves feel. And it is. And there's actually polling data in Baghdad which shows sectarian identity and religion is amongst the two lowest ranks, lowest ranked criteria. Now, don't get me wrong, the Shias will still vote for the Shias and the Sunnis will still vote for the Sunnis. But post-election, you know, when it comes to counting the votes, it becomes much more likely for there to be cross-sectarian alliances if the people themselves no longer reward sectarian manipulation. And this is actually one of the greatest problems, not just in Iraq, it's in the region. Politicians manipulating sectarian religious identity for purely short-sighted political goals.
Yeah. I mean, what are the other kind of, you know, we particularly in Australia, looking at the Middle East from a distance, in kind of mainstream media, the only reporting that you get on the Middle East, the crises and calamities and conflicts. But there, you know, there do seem to me at least to be lots of smaller scale positive things happening on the ground in the region. It's a great moment of great transition. And in moments of transition, yes, you do get crises, but you also get opportunities. I mean, what are the other kind of positive things you're seeing on the ground in Iraq?
In Iraq, the thing that stands out is the role that civil society organizations are playing. And many civil society organizations in the country, you know, report or get funding from political parties. So there's this very close connection to politics and the big political parties. But this cross-sectarian activism, which we barely see, if at all, mentioned in the media. I mean, in Ramadan, you had, and again, this isn't, you know, this isn't top-down people telling Sunnis and Shias, you know, to shake hands or go visit each other. But you had youth organizations who went to each other's mosques. So the Sunnis would come to Shia mosques in Ramadan and just help prepare the food or literally sweep the floors and clean the floors. And vice versa, you had Shias visiting Sunni mosques. And I think this is extremely encouraging because it is youth activism. And beyond that, we saw just ordinary civilians from the south going to Mosul after its liberation to show solidarity with the Maslawi people. You know, I'm embarrassed and ashamed to say this myself, but I knew very little about the Yazidi community in Iraq until the genocide against them happened. A lot of Iraqis knew very little about Mosul if they were from the south, or a lot of Iraqis in the north knew very little about the south. And this crisis, yes, it's been bloody. Yes, we've literally paid tens of thousands of lives, but it has brought the country together. And I think this is encouraging, even if it's not matched by similar levels of cooperation on the political level. At a grassroots societal level, these are positive signs that, again, you barely read about in the newspapers. It's not sexy news, right?
Yeah.
Sunnis visiting each other. But if there's killing, then that's what makes the headlines.
Yeah. One other element of that, of course, is what's happened with the Kurds. So you had the independence referendum last year. The results of that, fair to say, were fairly disastrous for the KDP, the Kurdish Democratic Party, that was pushing the referendum and seeming, you know, after many years in which the Kurds, and you know, including under Saddam, were very canny about the way they built their autonomy, you know, towards some eventual independence. It seemed that the KDP leadership wanted to make that final sprint. And they seem to have miscalculated in the sense that they've kind of now lost kind of Kurdish territory. What has that done in terms of the relationship between the central government and the Kurds? What has it done in terms of Kurdish aspirations? What has it done in terms of the future integrity of Iraq?
I think the word miscalculation is an understatement of sorts. I mean, this was by any standards, the greatest strategic mistake the Barzani family have ever done. Of course, the KDP and Barzani see themselves as leading Kurdish society towards independence and towards a statehood, which we should recognize is not just a right, it's a dream of almost every Kurdish civilian in Iraq. But the way he pushed for it in the middle of a war against ISIS, and it was extremely opportunistic in thinking that this was the perfect moment because Baghdad is busy elsewhere. But more important than that, everyone told him not to do it, and not just in Iraq. The Iranians, the Turks, the Americans, the British, all the European powers, everyone said, do not do this. Do not try to divide the country. And yet, despite all the warnings, they went ahead. And the irony is, you're right, after the 90s, the Kurds, up until now, enjoyed, you know, rights and privileges and control that are even beyond the constitution itself. They controlled the border crossings between Turkey and Iran, which according to the constitution should be the responsibility of the federal government. They controlled their own airports, and yet now they've lost this. They've lost the border crossings, they've lost the airports, and more importantly, they lost Kirkuk, which was, 50% of the oil located in Kurdistan was taken overnight by Iraqi forces in a relatively bloodless campaign. I mean, there were some skirmishes because some commanders either refused to obey orders or there was miscommunication, but by and large, it was an extremely successful operation. And the Iraqi army wasn't capturing Kurdish territory. It was redeploying to facilities they had lost because of ISIS. As the army withdrew, the Kurds moved in 2014. So, and by the way, this was welcomed by a lot of the Sunnis in Iraq, particularly in Kirkuk, who were fed up with Kurdish control. Of course, this has strained relations with Baghdad. They barely talk to each other. And just over the weekend, Iraq passed the budget law for the first time, not based on consensus, based on a majority vote, as is the case in most democracies that we know of. So I think that could be a sign of things to come. The Kurds, post-2003, there was no central government, right? The Americans destroyed literally the state. They dissolved the state. And so they had a disproportionate amount of power and influence in Baghdad. And one of the more immediate effects of this was the Kurdish share, which was 17% of Iraq's budget, would go to Kurdistan after, of course, sovereign costs. That's been cut down to 12.6%. Some Kurdish leaders are still adamant that they did nothing wrong and they're sticking to their guns. But I think a lot of the Kurds have realized it was a mistake to do this. And now more attention, as is the case in Baghdad, with people talking about corruption, cronyism, nepotism, the same thing is happening in Kurdistan. More and more attention is being drawn to the fact that, you know, why has Iraq had five prime ministers since 2003, but the Kurds have only had one president for the last 20 years? And these are important questions. And there were questions that the Kurdish leadership avoided for decades. And now it's hit, right? They've lost the oil, they've lost control of airports and ports, border crossings. And I think we're seeing a real crisis in Kurdish leadership also, to the extent that some people are asking the central government to intervene. And this is extremely significant.
I want to turn now to Iraq's foreign relations. We talked a bit about the US and Iran, but Iraq's relationship with its Arab neighbours in particular. You know, for many years under Saddam, Iraq was seen as this bulwark against, you know, Iranian export of the revolution, expansionism, whatever you want to say. What do you want to call it? Since the US invasion, since Iraq has largely been led by leaders from the Shia community, that relationship with Arab countries, in many cases, has been severed. What are the prospects for that improving in coming years, particularly with the Saudis probably being the most important of those kind of relations?
There hasn't been much change from the Iraqi side. Since 2003, the Iraqis have always encouraged their Arab neighbors to engage with the country. The problem was Saudi Arabia, essentially viewing Iraq as an Iranian outpost, right? As part of this expansion and, you know, revolutionary Iran taking over the Middle East. And they really did not want to touch Iraq. And that, of course, meant a lot of other Arab countries either couldn't or wouldn't engage with Iraq because of Saudi's position. But two important things have happened, which have fundamentally changed the status quo vis-a-vis Iraq's relations with Arab countries. One is the change in Saudi leadership, and two is US pressure on Saudi to engage with Iraq. And of course, the Prime Minister went in the summer and met with the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. That was an encouraging meeting because it showed the Saudis acknowledging that whatever happens, Iran will always be present in Iraq. Iraq has historical, linguistic, cultural, religious, political, security, economic ties with Iran. No one can change that. Iraq's longest border is with Iran. But I think what the Saudis have acknowledged is whilst Iran may always be present in Iraq, we as Arabs should also be present in Iraq. And actually, this was one of the messages the Iraqis were telling all the Arabs, that look, no one's denying Iran's presence in the country. No one's denying Iran has influence in Iraq. But one of the reasons why it's easier for Iran to have this influence is because none of you are there. There's nothing else on the other side. And actually, more so than just the Prime Minister's visit, we had the Ministry of Interior visit three times Saudi Arabia. And, you know, some viewed that as even more significant because the Iraqi Minister of Interior is a member of the Badr organization, which is extremely close to Iran. So far, it's been encouraging words, right? There hasn't been much action on the ground. We did actually have the opening of the Saudi-Iraq border. We did have the first plane to depart from Riyadh to Najaf in the south of Iraq, which was significant. But these are, for now, largely symbolic. I think it's too early to tell how that relationship will develop, but it will have a knock-on effect on how other Arabs view Iraq. My understanding was the Saudi message to the Iraqis was, you know, we recognize your Shia, and we recognize either by demography and elections that you will be in power, but you're also Arabs. And this is one of the interesting things that the Shia Arabs in Iraq can play that perhaps no other country in the region can play. By being Shia, yes, you'll have close ties with Iran, but by being Arab, you can also have close ties with the Arab world. Of course, the wild card, the thing we do not know yet, is how the Iranians are going to respond to Saudi engagement in Iraq. One of the significant outcomes of the visit between the Prime Minister and the Saudi Crown Prince was Saudi opening a consulate in Najaf. I mean, this is a big deal because just 200 years ago, the Wahhabis literally invaded Iraq and they sacked the holy cities in Iraq. And now there's talk of an official Saudi consulate. And after that, this is just a nice anecdote. The Iranian ambassador in Baghdad came to Najaf and met with one of the Grand Ayatollahs. And he was worked up and, you know, this is unacceptable. How can we allow the Saudis to have a consulate or spy den in a holy city? To which the Grand Ayatollah replied, but isn't there a Saudi consulate in Iran, in your holy cities? So again, it's encouraged.
Not at the moment. So.
I mean, there was one in Mashhad, and of course, the Iranians have an answer for everything, and you know, we're more in control of our security than the Iraqis are. But yeah, in a nutshell, I think it's too early to tell, but we do have encouraging signs.
And how does the Iraqi government view the situation now in Syria? So, you know, it seems clear that Bashar al-Assad will survive, but there is now a fight on for, you know, the what's left of the Syrian state. The Turks are making deep incursions in the north. It looks like that the Israelis and the Iranians are kind of lining themselves up for a kind of fight in Syria. How does the Iraqi government view all this?
The government now tries not to be involved, unlike the previous Iraqi government, which facilitated and allowed Iraqi fighters to go through. But that said, there are important actors in Iraq, armed actors and commanders of particular paramilitary forces. And I've met some of them, and they're quite frank about the fact that when we're fighting in Syria, we're fighting for Iraq also. As ISIS was an existential threat in Iraq, many Iraqis view the Salafi jihadists in Syria as an existential threat to stability in Iraq. And there is a sense that no matter what happens, you know, we cannot allow these people to win. But that's sub-state, non-state actors. The government is busy with a number of problems in Iraq itself and doesn't try to get itself involved in Syria.
There's a lot of talk, not necessarily from the most expert of circles, but there's a lot of reference to this kind of, you know, that this is a land, you know, the Iranians are constructing a land bridge through Iraq and Syria up to kind of Israel's borders. I mean, how credible is that? Do you see that as a serious threat, or is that more in the imaginings of the geostrategists?
Yeah, I mean, it's if you just look at the map, right, I mean, it sounds good when you're in D.C. in a conservative think tank saying, you know, the Shia crescent and Iran's creating a land border. But I actually posed this question to a very senior U.S. official and said, how do you propose they do this? And he laughed and he said, they can't. I mean, you could do that if you have a homogenous population from the Iranian border all the way to Lebanon. But in Iraq, in the western regions and north of Baghdad, we're talking 90-95% heavily Sunni-dominated areas. Yeah, they could, you know, with airspace in Iraq and Syria, they could send shipments to Lebanon. But apparently this is very costly versus a land route. Of course, Iraq is important to Iran and Syria is important to Iran and Lebanon is important to Iran. But this idea of a, you know, continuous corridor from Iran all the way to Israel's border, I think, is a bit far-fetched.
Before I take some questions from the floor, I wanted to ask you one question about, and this goes not just to developments in Iraq, but to the broader region. For a long time, outside observers, but also people within the Middle East, primarily seem to look at the region through a geostrategic, geopolitical lens. You know, if each of the states were billiard balls, how they kind of lined up against each other and bounced off each other. There was much less focus on what was happening within states. Given now that what really concerns people are less the kind of alignments between states, you know, we're well past the Cold War, and less even how much oil comes out of the region, what concerns people is terrorism and refugees, which means that what matters is less the geopolitics of the region and much more domestic reform that's happening in Iraq, that's happening in Saudi, that's happening elsewhere around the region. I mean, what do you see as the main prospects for real reform in Iraq in coming years, particularly tackling the big problems that afflict all countries in the region, corruption, providing enough jobs for kind of large and growing youth populations, dealing with some of the kind of serious resource questions that afflict these countries, particularly, you know, and I think we've seen in the Middle East in recent years that the effects of climate change are starting to be really felt, where you've had these record high temperatures. How hopeful are you that the current government and future governments will be able to kind of grapple with these reform issues?
I tried to give a quite optimistic overview of the situation, and now you're forcing me to discuss one of the biggest challenges the country faces. And on that, I'm afraid there isn't much optimism. So what's interesting when you talked about, you know, security services is whether you ask a Shia who lives in Basra or a Kurd who lives in Erbil or a Sunni who lives in Mosul, what do you want? They'll all say the same things. They want services. They want security. They want an end to corruption. But corruption is so systemic and endemic in Iraqi politics. And it's not just politics. It's seeped down to every level, almost every level of Iraqi society. I mean, I don't know if this is true or not, but there are rumors, even if you want to sweep the floors for the council, you need to pay a bribe to someone to get you that job in the first place. What is true is checkpoints, you know, physical military checkpoints are sold and bought in an unofficial market between ranking officers. Military ranks themselves are bought and sold. And that makes everything else extremely difficult to fix. So the Prime Minister has been very vocal about corruption. In fact, in his victory speech against ISIS, he said our next campaign is going to be against corruption. But then, and this is why I think as observers we need to be more realistic, the Prime Minister and the government itself is a product of a corrupt system. So how much really can the Prime Minister solve? As well-intentioned as he is, as much support as he gets from the international community. I mean, I wish I could show you this cartoon that was in an Iraqi newspaper after the Prime Minister's vows to combat corruption. The Prime Minister was standing on the edge of a cliff on a plank, and he was holding a gun to corruption. But corruption was what was grounding him and keeping him alive. And the connotation being, if the Prime Minister really goes after corruption, he'll lose his position. And corruption is also, it's not the only reason we had ISIS. There's a dozen other reasons we can talk about. But corruption was what enabled terrorism to spread so rapidly in the country. And you could literally be a ISIS terrorist in jail. But if you have the right amount of money and you pay the right person, you know, you're out. Yeah. And the flip side of this, which was unfortunately the case for many, is if you're innocent, but you don't have the money and you can't pay a bribe, you languish in prison and become a terrorist, right? Because this country isn't your country. So yeah, I'm not very optimistic, unless with the lip service paid now to combating corruption, we see big heads roll. And so far, you know, maybe just now the Prime Minister's in a position to go after some of the big heads. But until we see that happening, I don't think anyone in Iraq will have confidence in the government's ability to effectively combat this. And actually, this affects donors and the international community. When the government says, you know, give us $30 billion, give us $40 billion, of course, there are many generous countries who do give money, but they also want to see much more being done in how that money is spent in the country.
I'll take some questions from the floor now. So if you'd like to ask a question, put up your hand and wait for the microphone and tell us who you are. Just gentleman down here.
Thank you. My name is Iran Weiner. I just want to ask you, given the corridor that presumably, well, it looks like that Iran is establishing from Tehran to the Mediterranean, the northern part of Iraq, which is, of course, populated by Sunni, do you see that as a problem for Iraq, for Iran? Do you see that Iran will try to switch between the Sunni part of Iraq and the Shia part of Iraq so as to create a perfect corridor to block Turkey?
I mean, it's an extremely unrealistic scenario. There are Sunnis who live in the south of Iraq, and there are Shias who live in the north of Iraq. But what you're suggesting, in however we want to word it, is essentially ethnic cleansing, right? You're taking entire populations out of their homes, and I don't think anyone has the either the will or the capability. Even if we have evidence that the Iranians do want to do this, they're going to face obstacles, not just from the Americans and the region, but from the Iraqis themselves, that this is something at a time when the country is coming together after its defeat of ISIS. This idea of let's just switch homes and you come to the south and we'll go to the north, it's a non-starter. And
and that means that the corridor is a non-starter?
Yes.
That the corridor is a non-starter?
I mean, you can't enforce it from Iran to Lebanon if there are Sunnis in your way.
Roger.
Thanks, Haider. Roger Chenham from the Lowy Institute. Just going on a little bit from what Anthony spoke about, one of the many challenges facing Iraq and other countries in the region is diversification of the economy so that it becomes far less reliant on the one asset that Iraq has. Do you see much evidence of that occurring even at this early stage, understanding that foreign investors been vacant from Iraq for obvious reasons over the last 3 years or so? And if so, what kind of areas do you think Iraq would be looking at diversifying into, understanding as well that one of the preferred options for foreign investment in Iraq, Iran, and a range of these countries is labour-intensive investment, so that the unemployment rate can be reduced, taxes can be generated, and the population becomes more wedded to the central government because they're delivering economically?
I mean, I haven't seen any serious shift or move away from oil. Oil is just convenient. We have lots of it, and everyone does rely on it. One of the interesting things about the recent reconstruction conference in Kuwait, in which Iraq managed to get $30 billion in pledge, wasn't just the cash or the loans or the credit facilities that were given to the country. It was a chance for the government to showcase potential for investment. Now, that's a very long-term goal and dream, if you can get the private sector back into the country. And the government does want to encourage the private sector back into the country, you know, to diversify just away from being a rentier state. But the problem is, because of security, there's not much will to do that. And again, the convenience of oil just makes it easier just to base a $90 billion budget on your exports of oil.
Thank you very much, firstly. In the dynamic environment you've just described, with all these active actors, how influential do you think the diverging interests of both the US and Turkey will be in the region as a whole, and particularly with regards to Iraq?
The Iraq-Turkey relations were extremely problematic because, for the Iraqis, the Turks were essentially facilitating a lot of the jihad in Syria. They were opening up their borders, allowing fighters to go into Syria and cross into Iraq. The recent Kurdish referendum has forced the Turks and the Iraqis to come closer together. And I think this is also encouraging. I mean, we talked about this Iraqi-Saudi relationship, but the Iraqi-Turkish relationship now is extremely interesting. Even up until that point, it was extremely tense because the Turks are still literally occupying a part of Iraq in the north. They have a military camp. But despite that, you had Iraqi-Turkish cooperation on the border with Kurdistan. But US-Turkey relations, I think, are just much more confusing. And they've been confusing for a number of years. I mean, it got to a stage where in Syria, the US was supporting Kurdish fighters who were fighting Turkish-backed groups. But at the same time, the US government was supporting the Turkish government's campaign against Kurds in Turkey. So, you know, on one side of the border, these Kurds were freedom fighters. On the other side of the border, they were separatist terrorists. And I think that's just, you know, one of the many contradictions in US policy vis-a-vis not just Turkey, but the entire region.
I want to pick up something that, I mean, Roger alluded to, was the you know, Iraq's future prospects. One other thing that is quite striking about Iraq and Iraq's demography is how much the proportion, how much the population is in its 20s or younger. I think it's one of the highest in the Middle East. Oftentimes, this is seen as a problem. But as last year's Arab Human Development Report, published by the UNDP, also argued, it can also be a real boon, right? Because, you know, there are, it means that there is a very potentially a highly productive population there. I mean, what do you see as the main economic benefits, potential changes to Iraq that will come from having such a you know, let's leave. We know all the negative stuff, but what are some of the positive? What's some of the positive potential there?
The statistic is 70% or thereabouts are 30 or younger, and you know, I'm not an expert on economy, but one of the biggest impacts we've seen this have on a social political level is the fact you're dealing with a young population who does not remember Saddam, who does not remember the Iraq-Iran war. A young population who grew up and their first understanding of life was US occupation, sectarian conflict, civil war, ISIS. This poses a big challenge to the traditional political parties because for many years they would either directly or indirectly justify their incompetence or their failures or their corruption by saying, well, at least it was, you know, at least it's better now than under Saddam. But these young guys, they don't remember Saddam, and they have a lot less baggage than the current elite. And one of the most interesting slogans we saw during the anti-government demonstrations, again, largely led by youth and youth activists and civil society organizations, was "in the name of religion, dot, dot, dot." And of course, Iraq is dominated by Islamist parties. It's dominated by parties who rule in the name of Islam and give themselves religious legitimacy, but simply as a mask for their politics. And for perhaps many years, it was tolerated or accepted as a better alternative to Ba'athist dictatorship. But I think now, and again, this is a product of having a younger population, is there's much more awareness from the people that we were being lied to, that this really isn't about Sunni versus Shia, you know, 1400-year-old battle being played out on my street. And the slogans were basically, in the name of religion, they kill us. In the name of religion, they steal from us. In the name of religion, they pillage the country. And I think that awareness is going to have a big impact on politics. I mean, you talk to a lot of people in Iraq and say, what's the solution? They say the entire political class has to go, right? All of them have to disappear. Of course, it's not all, you know, that's the good side. But the danger is the younger generation being co-opted by the big political parties and just becoming an extension of them. But certainly there are opportunities, and you know, there's a excitement and a confidence and a optimism that hasn't been in Iraq, according to some observers who have been observing much longer than I've even lived, but since the 70s, since the late 70s. And I think that's encouraging if you're a young Iraqi. And I think if you're an Iraqi politician, you're on notice that the people are fed up and they do expect and they do want change.
And it's also encouraging.
Yes, of course.
Questions? Yes, at the back.
I was wondering if you had any insight into women's economic empowerment in Iraq, particularly with the changes to women being able to drive in Saudi Arabia recently, and also just UN reports which say that while Islamic State was quite active, there was more oppression of women in the area.
I mean, women in Iraq have enjoyed freedoms even before 2003 that many other Arab countries didn't provide for them. But Iraq, so there are opportunities. There's even a quota. So if you're a political party and you're listing candidates for the election, one in every four has to be a woman, right? That guarantees 25% representation in Iraq's parliament, which is, of course, less than half of what they actually are in the country, 50 or just over 50 percent. But Iraq remains, you know, there's no sugarcoating this, it remains a very conservative, for the most part, a very conservative country in which women don't have as visible a role as even in Turkey or Iran next door. I mean, they have freedoms, but it's not a rosy world for them.
Philip Luca, Independent. Do you see any sign of a long-time peace between Sunnis and Shiites in the Middle East?
I mean, it's a loaded question. I don't see the conflict as between Sunnis and Shias in the first place. Even if you look at Syria, there are Sunnis fighting Shias, and there are Shias fighting Sunnis, but the bigger problem is Sunnis fighting Sunnis. Right, you had 900 Sunni rebel groups ranging from, you know, ISIS and Al-Qaeda to other Salafi jihadis to the quote-unquote moderate rebels. Sectarianism, I talked about this in the Iraqi context of politicians manipulating sectarian identity, but of course this is happening at a regional level. And to be frank, it's not just the Muslims themselves who are doing this. You know, we have WikiLeaks cables from Syria as early as 2009, of the Americans recognizing the potential for Sunni-Shia tension in Syria and actually writing back to DC saying we can play on Sunni-Shia tension. The recommendation was let's focus attention on Iranian expansion in the region and work with the Saudi government to create more tension as a means to destabilize the Syrian government. Now, it's not all the West's fault, and it's not all the Muslims' fault, but I think at a societal level, we've gone beyond this sectarianism. And the real problem, and the real conflict, and I think this is what we should be paying more attention to, is the intra-sectarian conflict, not just between the Sunnis, but between the Shias themselves in Iraq. So in Iraq, in the previous elections, you had one Kurdish bloc, one Sunni bloc, one Shia bloc. It was very obviously an ethno-sectarian game. But now the Sunni bloc has been split up into multiple factions. The Shia bloc has been split up into multiple factions. The Kurdish bloc has been split up into multiple factions. And actually, I think this is encouraging because, as I mentioned, whilst Shias will vote for Shias and Sunnis will vote for Sunnis, it'll be much more likely for cross-sectarian alliances to be formed based on policy, based on your position on centralization or your position on Kurdistan, not on your Shia or your Sunni. Now, that said, I think Muslims need to be more honest on the other side about our history. And sectarianism in Islam is as old as Islam. You've had civil wars in the 7th century between Muslim communities themselves. So whilst I you know, criticize the West for fueling and fanning the flames of sectarianism, there are also Muslims on the other hand who say we didn't, you know, we lived happily ever after until the Americans came, and that's simply not true.
I'm Zahra, co-founder of Ahlul Bayt Society. ISIS seems to have an enormous online following. I was just wondering if that's reflective of the support they have on the ground.
No, it's a reflection of how sophisticated they were in their propaganda and their media outlets. The output of propaganda now, according to the US-led coalition, is 25% of what they were producing at their height. Many of these were fake accounts. They had literally, you know, sophisticated software to program bots and have a much larger echo and voice in the digital world than actually existed on the ground. And also, you know, ISIS, again, they were very smart about the way they would show we have support. You know, they'd go into local squares where there's executions and show local people. But of course, if you're living in an ISIS-held city and there's an execution and you're told to go watch, it's something you have to do. And a lot of the support was co-opted, right? It was on pain of death. But, you know, ISIS, no longer the case, but they were much more sophisticated when it came to propaganda and media than many of their adversaries. And, you know, you even talk to professional journalists and producers, the quality of their videos, forget the grisly nature of the executions, it was very, very high quality. A question that everyone in Iraq is now asking. Prospects for the religious minorities in Iraq. What happened was, because of the withdrawal of the Iraqi army, and also the withdrawal of the Kurdish forces in 2014, many of these minorities were at the mercy of ISIS. And of course, ISIS showed no mercy. And I think for them, and when I'm speaking specifically now about the Yazidi community and the Christian community, they were traumatized in ways that I think will take decades to heal. I remember going to Kurdistan and speaking with a Christian Iraqi whose family fled. Their neighbors would literally come into the house and take their furniture even before ISIS showed up at the door. You know, ISIS on the outskirts of the city and their belongings being plundered by neighbors they lived with for 30, 40 years, people they shared meals with. And I think that trauma is not easy to heal. And, you know, we talk about reconstruction and diversification and billions being poured in, but I think Iraq needs an army of psychologists and people who deal with post-traumatic stress in order to fix this problem. And what makes this more complicated is that the minorities themselves are not homogeneous blocks. So you have the Christian groups who have split loyalties, some to Kurdistan, some to Baghdad. The Yazidis, who some forces are loyal to Barzani, some forces get their salaries from Baghdad. What's clear is we're not going to go back to how it was before, and there will be some sort of permanent military mobilization of these communities. And that was one of their pleas back in 2014, especially to the Kurdish forces who fled. Look, if you want to flee, flee, but leave your guns, let us defend ourselves. And the Kurds, of course, they had orders to flee with their weapons. It's a very tough scenario for them, and many refuse to go back, and I don't blame them. You know, if this is how your neighbors treated you, why should you go back to your home?
Thanks. My name is Lynn Saville. I'm interested about the marshlands between Tigris and Euphrates. It's not related to the war, but I understand they've been partly drained, and I'm wondering if. What's the situation with those marshlands and with particularly with regards to climate change?
Well, I haven't paid particular attention to this issue, but there are farmers in the south who are complaining And it's as a result, unfortunately, of Iranian and Turkish dams being built. The water levels in the Tigris and Euphrates are reducing, and areas of the marshes are being drained because of those dams being built in Iran. There's a lot of anger and there's a lot of frustration. And actually, many people see the water crisis as the next big potential conflict between Iraq and Turkey, particularly. I mean, it's better than it was in the early 90s when it was completely drained by Saddam's regime. And we've seen a return of water, return of livestock, birds, but it's still not completely fixed.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's time to bring today's event to a close. It's been fascinating, as always, to chat with you, Khaira. We hope that you'll be back in Australia, not just on holiday, but we'll bring you back here at some stage in the future to talk to you again. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Khaira Al-Khoury.